Sermons from the Journey is an audio podcast of the weekly message preached by Reverend Rebecca Clark, pastor at Trinity United Methodist Church, Montpelier, Vermont, and blogging online at pastorbecca.com. Thanks for listening. So that little passage there actually begins with a reference to something that happened 6 days earlier, and makes me wonder what that could possibly have been 6 days earlier. And so if you jump back just a little bit to the end of chapter 16 of Matthew, Jesus has been talking to his disciples and he asks them who they think he is. He gives them kind of a quiz. Who do you say the Son of Man is? Who do you say that I am? And you know, Peter says you're the Messiah, and so that's good. Everybody's on board with that. And then Jesus says to them that he is going to die. And he says to them, if any of you want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will find it. What will it profit them if they gain the whole world but forfeit their life? What will they give in return for their life? For the Son of Man is to come with his angels in the glory of his Father and will repay everything for what has been done. Truly I tell you, there are some standing here who will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. And then 6 days after that, Jesus took Peter and James and his brother John and led them up on a mountain by themselves, and there he was transfigured before them. Now I imagine that up to this point, following Jesus had been a pretty exciting and uplifting thing, and it seemed like this was a great deal. I mean, it wasn't easy. It did involve leaving behind other parts of their lives and journeying with him and learning about God, but it was life-changing in those good life-changing ways. You know, those life-changing moments or experiences that are positive and that we feel like, oh, everything is on the right track. Yes, this feels right. I am feeling closer to God. I am feeling like this is where I'm called to be. And so things have been going along pretty well, and Jesus says some perhaps confusing things sometimes, but this is a wonderful and exciting place to be. And then all of a sudden, Jesus starts talking about how he's going to be killed. And then starts saying, and by the way, if any of you want to really be my disciples, you need to take up your cross and follow me. And I imagine that changed the feeling of what it was like to be one of Jesus' disciples in that moment. That all of a sudden, it was life-changing still, and inspiring and vibrant and drawing people closer to God, but that there was this sense of risk and of fear and of uncertainty, of danger, of looming and impending death on the horizon. And all of a sudden, this is not for kiddies. This is not entry-level stuff anymore. This is the real deal. This is serious stuff. And I imagine those disciples suddenly had to kind of step back a little bit and say to themselves, well, huh, what does it mean to follow Jesus now? Because I thought I had it, but now he's kind of changed it up a little bit. And I need to get my head around this, get my heart around this a little bit. And then 6 days later, he takes a few folks up a mountain, and they have an image of another new understanding of who Jesus is and who he will be, who he has been, what following him and listening to him and walking this journey with him might mean, that he's placed on this equivalent level, this higher level than the law and the prophets, than Moses and Elijah. And again, what it means to follow Jesus changes in the disciples' understanding, in their perception of what's happening here. Now, Peter, who's got to be, I'll say it again and again and again, one of my favorite people ever, because I just resonate with Peter so much. Peter reacts the way that so many of us react. Peter definitely reacts the way I react. So all these things are changing, right? And what it means to follow Jesus is changing, not like in little ways, like, you know, I need a new pair of shoes or something. Big ways. Are we talking about dying here? Are we talking about sacrifice? Are we talking about changing relationships with God and humanity and all of these things? Whoa, big ways. And so then in the midst of this revelation, we've got Moses and Elijah, who are dead, But there they are. And to process all of that, Peter defaults into technical problem solving. It's just become too much to process all of that stuff out there. And so he says, okay, we need a plan. We need a plan for this. We've got to have something, this is the way I see Peter, something that I can control, right? So this is way out of my control. But building, I can do that. So let's build three huts. And we'll build one for Jesus, and we'll build one for Moses, and we'll build one for Elijah. I can handle that. I can build three things. I have something under my control in the midst of all that is changing around us. Phew. I've been reading and discussing in an online discussion with some colleagues this really wonderful book by Anthony Robinson called Changing the Conversation, A Third Way for Congregations. I invite you to say that a few times fast. But he talks about something he gets from a man named Ronald Heifetz about the difference between a technical problem and an adaptive challenge. Okay, a technical problem is a problem, he says, that's pretty easy to discern what the problem is and describe the problem pretty easily. Okay, we got three people with no place to stay. Pretty easy to describe that and to figure out, therefore, what the solution might be. The solution to the technical problem is known, and it involves the application of an existing technique. In the case of Peter here, it involves building something. I can do that. And a technical problem often would be carried out by a person who's an expert in that field. So let's say that Peter couldn't figure out how to build something, but, you know, then he would sort of turn and look around, ironically perhaps, and say, hey, is there a carpenter nearby? Which there does happen to be. But is there a carpenter nearby who's an expert, a technical expert at building something, who can help us with this technical problem? Technical problems are great because they're easy to describe, easy to see what the answer is, and then you find or hire or solicit the right person with the right toolbox and they can fix the technical problem. Right? An adaptive problem is not. It's not any of those things. An adaptive challenge is hard to even name or define. What was that? That's an adaptive challenge. What did he mean? What does it mean for me to follow Jesus anymore? That involves a whole new way of being. That's not like something you can just find in a step-by-step diagram of how to get from point A to point B. This is a new thing. This is a new way of being. An adaptive challenge calls us to change. And there aren't a whole lot of experts, or really any experts, for adaptive changes, for changing who we are, how we live and function, how we relate to God, for example. There's no handbook for that. There's no expert to call on. It requires that we change. So an example that he gives, kind of a big macro church example, right, is about mainline Protestant Christianity and its decline in membership, right? We're kind of aware of this. For many years, the mainline Protestant denominations and congregations have named their problem in a technical way. They call it membership decline. And they know the solution: membership growth techniques or evangelism. And who does the work? Experts and authorities, that is, pastors, church growth or membership committees, denominational specialists, and the like. Except that it hasn't worked. It has not worked because we have been dealing with it as if it were a clear and known technical problem, a problem that could be called membership decline. But what we are dealing with is far larger, more complex matters. We are dealing with an adaptive challenge of a sea change variety, of which he speaks earlier in the book, but of culture changing around us, the church changing its function and its structure within that culture, and having to find a new way of being. And so finding the right technician doesn't help. Another example he gives is of medical care. And he says, you know, you have a person has a heart condition and goes to see a doctor and consult an expert, and there are prescribed a treatment plan. Well, let's see, says the doctor. We can try this combination of medications, or we can go with surgery, technical. But then she continues, either way, you, the patient, will need to make some changes in your life. You need to exercise more, reduce your stress at work, and change your diet. In other words, not all the work can be done by an expert or authority. Some of the work, the adaptive work, will need to be shouldered by the patient. which is a much more daunting task, and one we'd really rather not engage most of the time, whether we are patients being told that we need to exercise more, or people being told that we need to relate to God in new ways, or disciples being told that following Jesus means taking up a cross and being prepared to die, and to die to self, but also to die literally in following what they are following together. And so that's not something we like to hear. That's not something Peter likes to hear. And so sometimes when we're faced with these big, huge changes and this call to a new way of being, we have a tendency to look for the technical problem, or to name a technical problem, whether or not it's the right one, and to try to fix that, because we can control that. We can manage our own anxiety in the midst of that, because it's much easier. We have a clear plan. We have a technician or an expert, or if we don't, we find one, we hire one, and we can take care of that. And I was struck in this passage by one little line. And it says, you know, Peter is saying, oh, let's build these things. We're going to build one for Jesus, one for Moses, one for Elijah. And then the verse says, and while he was still speaking, they heard a voice. I love that. Peter's not done talking. He's got more of his plan. He's going to keep going. And while he was still speaking, God interrupted and said, this is my son, my beloved son. I'm pleased with him, and you need to listen to him. See, sometimes we get so focused on our technical problems and our plans to fix them that we need God to interrupt us while we're still speaking, to interrupt us and say, whoa, 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 this is my son. Have you met my son, Jesus, my beloved? You need to listen to him. You need to listen to what he is calling you to do, who he is calling you to be. He's calling you into a new way of being. I know that's scary. It's so scary that the disciples fall on the ground and cover their faces because they are overcome with the voice of God, yes, but I believe also with the call that they have to listen to Jesus, because that's scary. And it's so scary that Jesus walks over to them and puts his hand out and touches them and says, it's okay. Don't be afraid. Get up and come with me. And they see, finally, in that moment, they put aside the other stuff and they see just Jesus. And they follow him down off the mountain. As we plan and scheme and get technical, and there are technical things that do need to be fixed, and we handle those as they come up. But as we plan and scheme and get technical and take care of the things that we can control, we need to be ready for God to interrupt us and to interject Jesus into the midst of what we're doing and to say, hey, this is my son. Listen to him, to what he's calling you to do, to who he's calling you to be. That is to not be afraid, to feel his touch, to hear his voice, and to let him call us into a new way of being. And may we be open to that. Amen.
Amen.